been 6 months, it's my birthday, and it feels good to hear your voice. We took a ride through the hills, replayed all of the reasons I made that choice. We go around the bend, only to reveal what we couldn't see before. We're better off as friends. Baby, you can't stay. We both know I'm not there anymore. Tell me, is this how it goes when you let someone know that it's all for the best? We cut and we grow. Remember, I told you that we would be closer if we took some time further apart. Didn't it make you better? Aren't we better now? I know it made me better. Aren't we better? Breaking up in the middle of the night, no way. Somehow we fixed it. Now we're talking when we used to fight. Still bail me out when my money ain't right, no more. All the things I had to keep at bay stopped you, but I could have waited all day, all night. Think about why you wait. Wait. Tell me one more time. Didn't it make you better? Aren't we better now? I know it may be better. Aren't we better?
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome to Cult from the UBC. It's Thursday, November 9, 2017. I'm your host, Alamdi Alanion, a staff writer at the UBC. This show is broadcasted from CITR 101.9 FM, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Musqueam people. Cult hails from the culture section of the UBC, the University of British Columbia's student paper, and we talk about what's going on in the university's culture scene. We also talk to the creators and creatives involved in the various projects around town. This week on the show, the top 5 feminist movies to get you through the midterms, and an interview with Associate Professor Jacqueline Ferkins, the playwright of the upcoming UBC play called Wives and Daughters. Here's the show. It's November, and for UBC students, staff, and the general community, the great crunch is upon us. It's midterm season. Job evaluations are creeping close, and to be honest, everyone is pretty stressed out. Thankfully, the UBC is here for you. Our design editor, Natalie Morris, a national treasure, did us a favor and wrote us the top 5 feminist movies to get you through midterms. Natalie's here to talk about our article.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, Natalie. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, no problem.
Also joining us in the studio is an esteemed panel of experts on feminist movies. I mean, I don't know if you guys want to take that title, but they're going to take up, like, Natalie's call in the article, her call to arms, kind of, and, like, a healthy challenge to kind of, like, name more iconic, like, more in terms of quantity rather than, like, quality, but, like, yeah, more iconic feminist movies. So, okay, so we're going to have our inaugural feminist movies draft where we pick our favorite movies and why we love them. On the panel, we've got Emma Hicks, blog editor of the UBC.
Hi.
Yeah, former news editor Emma Partridge.
Hi.
And features editor Maura Whiten.
Hey there.
So Natalie, let's talk about the article you wrote for the UBC. Could you kind of give the listeners the title of the article and kind of like a quick synopsis of the article?
So it's top five feminist movies to get you through midterms. And it was kind of just a breakdown of my go-to top five feminist movies when I need a bit of a pick-me-up because, you know, feminist movies kind of make me feel empowered and like I'm doing stuff with my life. So it was Legally Blonde the musical, which is underrated just generally, The Devil Wears Prada, Hidden Figures, Mean Girls, and A League of Their Own. So those were kind of the short list of cool. A long list.
Cool. Are there any like disclaimers or like highlights or like things to note about the piece?
Well, just generally, just because it was a lot of what I was watching growing up, it is a pretty white movie list.
White panel too.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know, like, I'm a white lady and kind of how the industry was when I was growing up. A lot of these movies are very, very white, and they are not perfect, and in a lot of cases they are problematic, but I don't think that takes away from what they can offer.
Cool. Yeah, that was like a very nice primer for the game we kind of had set up for the draft, right? Thanks, Natalie. Now it's time for the drum roll. Anybody? No? Cool. Yeah. Boom, 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 boom. The UBC's 2017 Feminist Movies Draft. So here are the rules. Think of like a fantasy draft. We'll do three rounds. The goal is to pick the best movies, but you also get points for having movies on your team that are just really good. You can't pick the same movies, and you have to give a rationale on why you think that's the best feminist movie. I'll be like kind of moderating and like a neutral non-participant. In an authoritarian move, I will pick the draft order arbitrarily. The order is Natalie, Emma Hicks, Emma Partridge, and Maura Whiten. Yep. In yet another authoritarian move, I hope you didn't think this was a democracy. We'll be doing a snake draft. A snake draft just means that the order we picked earlier, that's how we'll go for the first round. And then after each round, we'll do the opposite order of the round we just did. Kind of like a windy path. And yeah, everybody good with the rules?
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so with the first pick in the UBC's 2017 Feminist Movies Draft, Natalie Morris selects
Mulan. Hardcore lady, defies her parents, makes her own life decisions, goes off, joins the army, falls in love, and aww. I don't know, I think the outcome's pretty good. She has a strong, strong
dragon.
Like, dragon, but also grandmother, like a figure. I always love the grandmother figure in Mulan. And by the end of the movie, they accept her as a woman in the army. And in the real life Mulan, she is an actual general by the end of her lifetime as a woman.
Interesting. Oh, History 101 with Natalie.
Yeah, that's you know Mulan is a documentary?
Okay, so with the second pick of the Feminist Movies Draft, we have Emma Hicks.
The Princess Diaries, the entire
I've never seen that.
What? How are you on this panel, Emma Partridge?
Well, I'm white.
Julie Andrews, Anne Hathaway.
Why would you say that?
The actress who plays Lily, whose name I do not know in real life. They are all so cool. And they're a princess of Genovia and the queen of Genovia. They just slay all day.
What's it about?
It's basically about this girl who is like a really big outcast in high school, Anne Hathaway, and she has curly frizzy hair and glasses, and then they have that movie makeover of 2005 phenomenon.
So she just looks like regular Anne Hathaway.
My favorite movie trope is when they take like a really hot girl and they're like, look at Liz, and she tripped. She has glasses. She's so ugly. And it's like, you're Anne Hathaway.
Okay, but how about the fact that she was only taken seriously after she went through a makeover and complied with standards of beauty?
I think that also in that movie, yeah, like I agree that it was kind of that classic trope Emma just articulated, but also like she doesn't change as a person. Like she's still her like goofy, down-to-earth, smart, intelligent, confidence, or like assertive self. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of like showing that, you know, you may need to, like your life may change, but you can still remain genuine and yourself.
So long as you're hot.
So long as you're hot. Exactly.
And Hathaway level song, though.
I know.
But Lily keeps her grounded. She calls her out when Anne Hathaway's character is being a little ridiculous and going to parties and getting caught making out with dudes, because we all know that's not allowed.
Wait. I've never seen this movie, but is that not okay in this movie?
She gets like...
Oh, man. I forgot that Sandra totally always shamed. In this movie.
For making out with the guy.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, it did suck.
Wait, is that like, are they like critiquing that? Or is it like, yeah.
They're critiquing it.
Good. Just checking.
But then in the second movie, in the second installment, she has to pick a prince to marry based on photos and eligibility and age. And she ends up with really annoying Chris Pine in this movie.
And she has to pick because the Constitution of Genovia says that she must be married before she ascends the throne.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like...
Which brings up a lot of, like, classist questions.
But exactly. Is that, like, a reversal where the woman has to, like, select a guy? Because usually it's the other way around where men are just like, bring me.
Also,
yeah.
It's like,
so.
I don't know. Aside, the royalty in, like, Scandinavia was, like, way... I'm sorry if you're listening to this, royal family of England. It's just way hotter than the royal family of England and the United Kingdom. Just way hotter than the royalty in the United Kingdom. And the fact that they weren't featured at all, I think it loses just on that.
Fair.
Emma, Patrick, you want to go next? Third pick?
Easy A. That was a movie I watched in high school and was kind of a turning point in terms of how I was like, oh, slut shaming is a terrible thing, because in high school I think you notice that, but you don't necessarily have the tools to like articulate it. And I think Easy A was really good for being like, you know why it sucks? Because it's actually no one's business. And then you're like, oh, cool. I got this. And also Emma Stone is wonderful. And she's really smart in the movie without being pretentious. Yeah, I just really like that movie. It's like very good. And she has a very healthy relationship with her parents about sexuality too, which I feel like is a really big part of why that movie is like a good feminist thing.
Yeah, definitely. That relationship with the parents.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah. Stanley Tucci.
Oh, gosh. She's my dad.
What a
daddy. I'm so sorry now. yeah, so sorry. That's not a very controversial pick.
That's a good one.
If I remember Easy A correctly, her friend like almost immediately ditches her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's her name?
Ally Machalka.
Yeah.
Wait, she ditches
Kelsey from Bill of the Future.
She ditches her for what?
Just like because... Like, Emma Stone's character is apparently sleeping around.
Yeah, but I think her character is, like, very kind of, like, revealed as being part of, like, the problem. Because her whole... There's, like I felt like at the school that Emma Stone's character went to, there was, like, the super Christian, like, slut-shaming people, like Amanda Bynes. And then there was that other girl who just, like, wanted everyone to think of her as, like, a slut. And neither of them had, like, a really healthy relationship with sexuality. Mm-hmm. They're both just trying to force themselves into these boxes.
I thought it was cool that they showed that, like, duality of, like,
yeah.
Both, like, uber, like, abstinent, virginal, whatever, and, like, and then also it contrasted with, like, you know, sexually promiscuous friends, mm-hmm. but they're both kind of passing the same judgment.
Okay, so for the fourth pick of the feminist movies draft, we got Moira.
Awesome. I'm going to go with Ever After, which is the 1998 live-action Cinderella remake with Drew Barrymore. Has anyone seen this movie?
I've seen the Anne Hathaway version of Ever After. Stand by my Anne Hathaway love.
You mean like, wait, no, not Ella Enchanted.
Ella Enchanted. Isn't that like good the same?
Movie. No, Ever After is so much more than Ella Enchanted.
What's it about?
So essentially Ever After is like this feminist retelling of Cinderella, and Drew Barrymore, queen that she is, plays Danielle. It's set in 15th century France, and she, her mother passed away, as did her father. She's living with like a stepmother who hates her and these two stepsisters, and she impersonates a noble woman to free one of the servants who had been sold from their estate, as the stepmother is trying to make money as she's laundering or like running out and overspending. And she goes and she dresses up in her mother's old dress, and she runs into the prince there, and he is immediately taken by her, and they kind of verbally spar. She's very well read. Her father really instilled like a love of education into her. And so they kind of start out on this like really sweet like courtship of like intellectualism. And at the same time, the prince is under a timeline to find a bride. Or else he will be married to the princess of Spain, a woman he doesn't love.
Yeah, but Spain though.
Spain though, right? Those beaches. Am I right?
It's like own territory, right? I mean,
yeah, true. So but anyways, it's a great show, and she's a hardcore, and she saves the prince's life, and she teaches him about like being a fairer and more ruler, more fair ruler and leader. And, you know, there's bumps along the way, but it's kind of like a very empowering love story where it's not just happening to her. She's seeking out and challenging him in what he knows as well.
I have not seen this movie. Oh. My only concern would be the portrayal of Roma people.
I'm not particularly sure what the context was in 15th century France. However, they were portrayed quite positively because in the end they kind of like surround them and it's a little bit comical. And then at the end she says... the prince says, like, let the lady go, like, your quarrel is with me, and he says, okay, she can take whatever she can carry, and she puts the prince over her shoulders and carries him out, and they're like, oh, man, like, come back, like, we'll get you a horse, ha, 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 and they end up, they're all, like, hanging out, like, later that night, so I think it's, she kind of advocates all along the way for, like, the people who don't have much. There's also, like, a Leonardo da Vinci plotline in there.
Okay.
It's really cool. It's great. Or, sorry, 16th century, 1500s. It's great.
Okay, so the fifth pick goes to you, Moira, Snake Draft, right?
Snake Draft. Yeah. So my next pick is The Sapphires, which is an Australian film.
Is this where we get it? You're an intellectual. Pick something mainstream.
Okay, I'm sorry. I have to pick this one. Well, my mom introduced me to The Sapphires. We love watching it together, and it was in the last 5 years. It's a movie set in the 1960s during the Vietnam War about these four sisters and their cousin who are like Australian indigenous people, so Aborigines as they're called in the movie. And essentially they've kind of lived these like very different lives, and they all love making music, and they're in a band together, and they get hired by the American Armed Forces or the American military to tour Vietnam and sing for the troops to kind of like bolster morale. And Chris O'Dowd plays their manager, who's this Irish, he's Irish in real life, but he's also Irish in the movie, and who kind of falls in love with one of the sisters. And it's a cool commentary on what it means, like on colonization and like what war in a time of colonialism meant for the United States and for Australia. And also it's just like this amazing, empowering show of like sisterhood and family when this family's kind of been put through the ringer in terms of like Australia's policy of removal of Indigenous children.
That's a really good pick.
The music is bomb.
Yeah. This sounds great.
It's the like viewing party.
Yeah, like,
okay, cool.
Okay, so sixth pick, Emma. This is Emma P. Emma
Hi.
P. Yeah. Hi.
Hello. Okay, I'm picking Bad Moms because I think it's a good commentary on how much we judge each other to be perfect in like feminist, quote unquote, like typically feminist ventures like motherhood and domestic stuff that none of us know how to do. Let's get real. and just I don't know. I liked it. I called my mom after it. Anyways,
aww,
yeah, that's so sweet. Have you seen it?
I haven't, even though I do love Mila Kunis.
Yeah, so it's good. It's garbage, but like it's a good message. Like it's a bad movie, but yeah, it's basically like Mila Kunis has like these two kids and is constantly trying to be the perfect mom, and then the head of the PTA is really like fostering that sense of like you have to be a perfect mom, and she kind of goes toe to toe with her and gets laid along the way.
Woo.
Good for her. Gets an awesome divorce.
Just shout out to divorce.
Shout out to divorce.
1918.
But did you guys see? They did. They're doing Bad Moms 2 promo.
Yes,
now on Ellen. On Ellen the other day, Kristen Bell was telling this story about how she has like a newborn and she was breastfeeding from home and like got Skyped into an interview with like for a table read, but she didn't know she was on Skype. She thought she was just like on a phone call. And so she started using her breast pump and Mila Kunis and this other actress whose name I do not know, the other mom, were like frantically texting her, apparently being like, you're on Skype with like a bunch of dudes right now, basically. And none of the guys that were in this board meeting knew what a breast pump was. And I was like, you would, I don't know, maybe they're not dads, but...
I think it's
pretty common knowledge. Like, yeah. I don't know if they could actually see her boobs or mm-hmm. just hear it. Hear the pump. So.
Is it like her, they make like beeping noises? Like Sheryl Sandberg and her like Lean In book or, you know, as problematic as it is, she talked a lot about like how the beeping noises made people think on the phone that she was like walking by construction.
Oh, yeah. But still.
That's a good commentary on, like, the themes of the film.
Yeah. Right? I thought so.
Interesting.
Yep. For the seventh pick of the 2017 Feminist Movies Draft, we've got Emma Hicks.
I'm going to pull out another queen right here, Sandra Bullock, Miss Congeniality. Probably one of my favorite Sandra Bullock movies of all times.
Yeah. April 25th.
It's so cool in that movie. I can't even begin to explain. Kicks so much butt, and she
literally. What's
the idea of your perfect date? Sorry?
April 25th, because it's not too warm and it's not too cold. All you need is a light jacket.
It's one of the best lines in movie history. And yeah, she saves the world. Not the world, but like a beauty pageant from... a bomb.
Okay, I do have a question. I love Miss Congeniality.
Yeah, who doesn't?
Who doesn't, right? But, like, do you think... So, I was always a little bit iffy about how some of her male colleagues treated her after she, being the woman, was, like, kind of pushed into having to dress up as the beauty pageant queen. And then as well, how, like, they kind of already ridiculed her for being, like, a little bit mannish and, like, frumpy, in quotations, as beforehand when she didn't put a ton of effort into her appearance or like was a little bit more like closed off. So like, do you guys think that that was a commentary or was it kind of just saying the way it was?
It definitely could be a commentary on like the police force because women are super unrepresented in like police forces. Mm-hmm. So it could just be a commentary. It's been a while since I've watched the movie, so I'm not 100% sure. And I don't feel comfortable being like, oh yeah, it was a feminist choice.
Okay.
To do that, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, I don't know if it was exactly a feminist choice. I wouldn't categorize it as that, but I do agree. I had like the exact same thoughts, but I do think they played with the trope enough to make the men appear as pigs, to be completely honest, and not like these desirable men. Mm-hmm. None of them appeal.
Doesn't she end up with one of them though?
Yeah, Benjamin Bratt.
Yeah, she does end up with one of them. But, like, you could see that coming from the beginning. Like, you just knew. Their witty banter. It's their witty banter, true. I'd like to say, is what brought them together, not her looks.
Yeah. My whole ish with Miss Congeniality, which, like, if, like, I'm going to take issue with it, I'm not going to like any of these movies or any movie, really, is that, like, there's always this, like, the protagonist, if she's a woman, she's always, like, kind of more masculinized, like deliberately, like she's kind of like funny and one of the boys and can do that. Mm-hmm. Whereas like women who are like traditionally more feminine and do things like beauty pageants are kind of demonized and they're like, oh, look how vain she is, which like isn't true. Like of beauty, like I understand like all the problems with beauty pageants and how specifically when it's tied into capitalism, how problematic it is. But like a lot of beauty pageant winners are philanthropists and athletes and mothers and stuff. And it's like, I don't know. I didn't like how black
not
and
mothers,
white.
But
they can't keep their body.
No. It's in the rules of Miss Canada, Miss America, Miss like you have to have been never pregnant before.
Okay, I meant after the fact, but I also didn't know that. That's really screwed up.
Well, America's president.
Oh, yeah, he supports them.
He owns that.
Yeah. Never mind. Beauty pageant, I hate them. Let's demonize them.
Okay, so with the eighth pick of the UBC's 2017 Feminist Movies Draft, Natalie Morris selects...
Suffragette, which is a movie that... I'm pretty sure it's, like, blockbuster. A few years ago it came out, and it's just the story of an individual first-wave feminist in London while they were trying to get the right to vote. So I think it was really interesting that they took an individual story
compared to kind of the broader story. And I think it actually got criticized for that, but I think it made it stronger because it wasn't about the movement. It was about one feminist during the movement, which I think was really interesting. And I loved it. And I was like, wow, my foremothers are like such strong women. Except like other than the fact that it's first wave feminism. So very white.
Did you see, I've actually never seen this movie. I've only seen parts of it, but like every time I see like parts of it, I cry. So like, I feel like I agree with you. Like I cry like, oh my God, this is so awesome. So I feel like I agree with you. But then did you see afterwards to promote the movie, they came out with these shirts that Meryl Streep and
Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah, they promoted and it said, I'd rather be a rebel than a slave. And people were like, oh, this is not okay.
Because, definitely.
Yeah.
Not
chill.
Not intersectional at all.
And it kind of, it kind of tapped on some of the problems of the movie. I'm like, yeah. Anyway, I thought that was kind of bad because it's like, yeah, obviously.
Okay, so with the 9th draft pick, Natalie, go for it.
So all of the Harry Potter movies.
Emma? Sorry, you can only pick one. I'm sorry. That was I thought that was like explicit.
No, dude, she's got to pick them all.
I think the portrayal of Hermione is really interesting, particularly because it's the vast majority of the books and the majority of the movies are from the point of view of Harry, who is problematic.
He's the most like mayonnaise character.
Yeah, who's like privileged and ignorant and kind of dumb about a lot of things.
He's dumb about a lot of things. Yeah.
And especially the like pure blood. Yeah, like that whole thing. I think it was like really interesting how J.K. Rowling played it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was definitely like that's why.
Like
I'm
he's a white boy. Like she writes him like a teenage white guy.
Yeah.
Like,
and
on purpose.
It's like I was thinking about this in the second movie when Draco Malfoy calls her like a mudblood for the first time and Harry just sits there and is just like, I don't know what that means. I don't know. And I'm like, Harry, your best friend is constantly put down because of like who she is as a person. Learn some facts, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know. He was like 12.
Keeping it from him, though. Like people aren't pretty deeply keeping it from him, though.
Yeah, like, yeah. So I'm
very defensive of Harry.
I know.
I see
like
both sides.
I think Harry number 6, like the 6th book of Harry. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, that boy.
I'm so troubled.
Well, and to be fair,
he has
super.
Comment on like how nobody
I'm gonna
kind of
like I don't want to I don't think I'm allowed to defend like Harry actually, never mind, but I think that like we might be reading too much into like J.K. Rowling's like portrayal and like intentions, especially because like there's a lot of stuff that people have like, you know, criticized her about, like in terms of like relation to like race and stuff.
Yeah.
Like she doesn't really like hit the
she's not
doesn't hit on the head exactly. So I don't know if like her portrayal of like the mudblood or like the what's the word, portrayal of that entire like debate or discussion would have been like necessarily like the best coming from J.K. Rowling. So I'm not gonna like,
oh yeah, like she's a white woman
exactly,
too.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
like the thing about the books and the movies is you're seeing it from Harry's perspective.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these like Hermione is only hot until after she gets cosmetic surgery, or like she's only hot after she gets cosmetic surgery.
Wait, what?
What are you talking about? Are you reading like a different? Are you reading
like
fanfic or
like,
something?
No. In book 4, when someone puts a curse on her teeth, and then they make them really big, and then they were like, "Oh, Hermione, you're so hot. What happened?"
Yeah.
And she was just like, "Oh, I got like my teeth a little bit smaller because they were a little bit big before, and it made me self-conscious."
Yeah, she kept them. Which is super frustrating because, like, obviously that scene's kind of problematic, but in some ways it's kind of like Hermione is someone who absolutely unequivocally values, like, who you are.
Oh, yeah.
And your intelligence over your looks, and she never compromises that. So it might just be one of those things where it's like, if you're insecure about this, do it.
No, yeah,
100%. And I feel like she's one of those girls who actually does do it for herself, which I really like, because she doesn't get with Ron until, like, 3 years later.
I was trying to say, like, that she was so strong this entire time. It was just like from the perspective of a lot of the dudes in the book.
Yeah. And I kind of love that too, because it's kind of like it problematizes the whole duality of like you can either be hot or you can read books. And it's like she's
in Hermione's
both. She's girly sometimes.
Yeah. Like, which is like totally valid. And
yeah.
I don't know. I related to Hermione a lot as
a
kid.
Me too.
Okay. So the 10th pick for the UBC's 2017 feminist movies draft, Emma Hicks, you want to go?
Charlie's Angels.
Tell us why.
Yeah, tell us why first.
Okay, first of all, it's not because they're all just skinny women who can fight their way to saving the day. They are so physically capable of taking down all these bad men, and they
and women can be villains too.
Mm-hmm. Well, women too, but like from the one I was thinking, like Full Throttle, like Charlie's Angels. Oh, Full okay. Throttle.
Another one's like the Irish.
I've never seen this.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Okay. Isn't their boss though still like? Don't they have like a boss and he's Charlie?
Yeah,
but, like,
yeah Charlie. Charlie's like. Not in the movies though. Like well, it's all Cameron.
Yeah,
Jones,
he's kind of like he's like kind of like Zordon
and Lucy
Gordon from Power Rangers, where he's not actually like involved in it. He's just like, well, he's also still giving them directives though.
He's
so,
like,
yeah.
Ladies, I have a job for you. I don't know.
Come over to my house for half an hour, then go fight some crime. I don't care. It's like it's kind of like the same trope as like Miss Congeniality, right? Like
yeah.
You can fight crime as long as you look really good doing it.
I think it's also like because they were so sexualized.
Yeah.
I wonder if. There's a difference between embracing your sexuality and men, people of power or systems of power asking you
yeah.
to present your sexuality. I think those are two very different things.
Okay, so with the with the 11th pick of the UBC's 2017 Feminist Movies Draft, Emma Partridge.
Okay, I was going to go with Moana, but then I remembered this movie that's probably one of my favorite movies, and I want to see if you guys have seen it. Have you seen Speak with Kirsten Stewart?
No.
Okay.
Just defend your like,
yeah. Okay.
What's about?
Like, yeah.
Okay, so I think it's really exceptional, and it impacted me in a lot of ways, and I, full disclosure, I read the book first, but I think the movie, like, totally does it justice. And, yeah, go and watch it. It's about a freshman in high school who is sexually like she's raped at a party and she kind
oh,
of
oh yes yeah. I've read the book
right yeah and she becomes like mute basically like she can't speak and nobody really is except her art teacher is kind of making any effort to like understand what she's going through at the time and she like spoilers eventually kind of is able to talk about it and like accuses the guy who tries to assault her again and then women like other women come to her aid and stop him, which is really great. But it kind of like delves into a lot of issues that like I think a lot of high school students read it because it delves into like a lot of issues of like consent and whose fault it is and stuff like that. It's never your fault, by the way, just putting that out there. But it definitely, like, the guy kind of tries to make it seem like it's her fault because he's like, you were at a party, you were drinking, you're not even attractive, like, why would I even go for you and stuff like that. And it kind of, yeah, I really like that movie a lot. Do you remember this movie?
I kind of want to watch it now.
You should. It's so good.
I've read the book.
Yeah, the book's, like, the movie's, like, pretty much the book. It sticks really close. Yeah, really like that movie.
Just as an aside, Sask is on the third floor of the nest if anyone needs your services.
Yes.
Thank you. For the 12th pick of the feminist draft, we've got Maura. Go.
Okay. My pick is going to be Bridesmaids, which
yes.
If you've ever seen it, the opening scene is probably the most awkward sex scene I've ever seen, my own included. And I actually saw the movie in theaters with my family, which included both my parents,
oh
my sister, and my grandmother,
no,
and my cousin.
It. Wow.
But it was, you know, I really like that movie because it is completely not guy-centered
mm-hmm.
drama whatsoever. It's, like, about women figuring out their crap and working on their relationships and kind of weathering life changes together. And Kristen Wiig is hilarious, and she's a businesswoman, and she is picking her like up her the pieces of her life as she's trying to grapple as her with her best friend's marriage and like
mm-hmm.
this new woman who's kind of like seems like the shinier version of herself who's taking over in her best friend's life. And I just like really loved that it was like about women supporting women and figuring out stuff between themselves, and it wasn't just supporting that trope of like women only ever have issues when it's over a guy or when it's when it's like romantically
mm-hmm.
inclined, because it was just really cool because yeah stuff like that goes on all the time and they don't make movies about it.
To quote Natalie's article, women helping women, Melissa McCarthy.
Yes,
that scene at the near the end.
Yeah,
with Kristen Wiig.
It's so sweet.
Climb like a tree.
And anything with Melissa McCarthy I will watch whatever she does.
The only thing with that Melissa McCarthy speech, like, I cry and I love it a lot, but I feel like in some ways it kind of simplifies depression. Like, she's really deeply depressed because her business fell under and, like, her fiance, I think, or partner of, like, a long time left her. And then Melissa McCarthy is like, you just kind of need to choose, which, like, is true enough. She needed to take some active steps towards getting better, but it was also a little bit like, that's not really how that works. Like, she needs to, like, she's sad.
That's very true, I guess, with the simplifying depression
Everything else, completely.
All right, so thank you all for being here.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Up next, we have an interview with Jacqueline Firkins, an associate professor at UBC's Theatre School and the playwright of Wives and Daughters. The play was adapted from a serial novel of the same name from the 1800s, and it goes from November 9th to November 25th. But first, some PSAs.
UBC Theater and Film presents a world premiere shining with love and possibility. Wives and Daughters by Jacqueline Firkins, based on Elizabeth Gaskell's Victorian serial novel, is a charming romp of love convoluted by hidden desires and expectations.
I like to be liked, but when people carry their affection too far, they become troublesome.
Cynthia's a sweet girl and charming, but she was always in some spot of trouble. She wasn't mischievous exactly, but mischief seems to follow her.
Join us from November 9th to 25th at the Frederick Wood Theater.
After a certain age, a daughter becomes inconvenient.
So we must stop being inconvenient daughters and become inconvenient wives?
Theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is the big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke you every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or f*** with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Nikkei National Museum's Hastings Park 1942 exhibit marks the 75th anniversary of Japanese-Canadian internment. Visit the exhibit until January 13th to see Japanese Problem, a contemporary performance piece which offers a glimpse into a dark episode of history at the Pyrenees Livestock Barn. Nikkei National Museum is located in Burnaby, and entry is by donation.
Welcome, Jacqueline Firkins. It's a pleasure to have you here in the studio.
Great to be here.
Yeah, so just to lay some groundwork and set up the interview, could you tell me about yourself and who you are?
My name is Jacqueline Firkins. I'm on the full-time faculty in the Department of Theater and Film here at UBC. I'm in my sixth year now, so I've been here for 5 years. And I primarily teach costume design and construction, but also have a background in play analysis, a little bit of writing, and a little bit of everything involving producing theater.
Cool. Yeah. So you're an associate professor and theater design focused, right?
Yeah.
You're adapting a play called Wives and Daughters that goes on from November 9th to 25th, right?
Correct. Yeah. Adapting the novel. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So as a primer, could you kind of tell the listeners like a synopsis or a sneak peek of, if you will, about what Wives and Daughters is about? And let's start with that.
Yeah, Wives and Daughters is a novel that Elizabeth Gaskell wrote in the 1860s, and she wrote it in serial form, so it came out episodically. And it focuses around a group of people in a small town in England and the kind of trials and tribulations of their daily lives. The central family is the Gibson family. It's a young girl who has just inherited a new stepmother and stepsister.
Molly
Gibson. And they burst into her life and bring everything crashing to a halt that she's come to know and love. So she has to grapple with, you know, a stepmother who wants to change everything about her, a stepsister who seems to have everything figured out in life while Molly's still kind of struggling to figure out who she is, and just make new choices with the new things that enter her life.
Cool, thanks. So how does your adaptation differ from the original novel?
The original novel follows three families, so the Gibson family is at the heart of it, but we also have these other two families, the Hamleys and the Cumnors, and the novel is huge. Anybody who's read the novel knows that it takes a long time to get through hundreds of pages of material, and there's no way I can put that on stage in 2 hours. So I really focused in on the Gibson's family, pared away the other two family stories to really support that central story. And yeah, really just tied into her narrative, her arc, and where she goes from start to finish in the novel, and then kind of stripped other things away.
Yeah, I kind of also looked at like the history behind it, and like the story is like the story behind the story is pretty wild. Like I think Mrs. Gaskell dies right before like finishing the story, right at the climax, right? So I wonder how that like you know. Really factored into the story's never finished, right? So like I wonder how that factored into the adaptation of the play.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. She did die before it was finished. She left some notes about how it was going to be finished, but the published novel, if anybody looks at the novel, her editor basically wrote a postscript saying, here's what we think would happen. We know that this is how the central story ties up. A lot of the other things are kind of left open. So what that allowed us to do in adapting it was really have some freedom with how that ended. As long as we tied up the plot the way she wanted to, we could actually make the ending a little bit more modern than it might have been in her time. So, for example, we're watching this relationship with Molly Gibson, who has this bent for science, and in the 1860s, that just meant she got to read some magazines. She didn't actually get to do anything with that. So for us, we get to take a little bit of liberty with where she might go with her interest in science. So we follow her intent, but we bring it into the 21st century a little bit.
Cool. Thank you. So I think one thing that I found interesting was that, like, you know, I guess Lady Cumnor was, like, one of my favorite characters just from, like, reading the synopsis and everything. And, like, I am wondering if, like, Lady Cumnor is still there. At least, like, just, like, still there?
She's still there,
okay,
yeah.
Cool.
She was, it's funny, when I was trying to pick and choose which characters to keep in the play, and the play is written for a specific group of actors in our department, so I knew starting out working on this play, I needed to do a play with 3 roles for men and 6 roles for women, so I had to pick those roles accordingly. And at one point, there was a version of the play that did not have Harriet Cumnor in it. But she really is a catalyst for change in this. She's sort of she's the character who has the most wealth and the most power in the story. And she's fascinating in the novel because she's part of this very conservative family. But even in Gaskell's version, she totally breaks out and is the young daughter who has no interest in getting married, has no interest in being sort of part of this little family unit and having children. And in the 1860s, that was shocking. And even today, in the 21st century, we still have these discussions about who are women supposed to be when they grow up? Are we expected to marry and have families? So here we are with this character who's been around now for 150 years, who was already sort of branching out and saying, there are other ways we can live our lives as women.
Fantastic, thanks. I'm curious as to what drew you to Wives and Daughters as a piece of art. Are there any things in the story in particular that, like, jump out to you, like, just, like, you just had to write about this and you had to, like, what were the things that you found striking about the story?
I think that Gaskell just has a great way of touching in on just basic humanity, the things that we want, the things that we need, and how we go about getting them. She has a very straightforward language. When I was looking for material to adapt, I'm very drawn to female writers from the 19th century. In terms of emerging voices, in a time where women didn't have the same kind of voices we have today, how did they express their world? I think we see a lot of history as seen through the eyes of men. They were writing it, they were creating it, and many times they were at the helm of whatever the changes were. And to get to see that world through a woman's eyes is just fascinating to me. So I was drawn to her because her language is so straightforward. She's looking at things that the humor of what happens when you need to borrow something from a neighbor, you know, and the fact that she has this range of characters where I think we often think of women's writing in the 19th century as being Jane Austen, who's of course brilliant, but her stories revolve around young women needing to get married. And here was Gaskell saying, like, there are a whole bunch of other ideas about young women. Yes, we are in a world where in order for a woman to move out of her parents' household, she does need to get married. She doesn't have other options. But she was presenting other stories and other conflicts. She has these two sisters who have made the choice to live together, for example, and not get married. And what is that kind of relationship about? So she gives us a really great variety of female characters in the 19th century when I think we have these preconceptions about who those people are. And she busts through that a little bit.
Why did you feel it was necessary to adapt this novel into a play now? Like, what is it about, like, now that, like, you just feel like, yeah, this is the right time for this story to be adapted? Or is it just, like, generally, like, you just love to adapt mostly just female characters?
Well, I did look at a lot of different material when I was trying to pick what to adapt, and one of the things I was looking for was source material that had a lot of good women's roles in it. So it wasn't just, here's the one great female character surrounded by a bunch of men, because I knew I was writing for 6 women and 3 men for this. So partly I was just drawn to it for the range of roles it had. But I also feel like there's something I enjoy about literature that's been around for a while, and it's way to kind of show a mirror at contemporary society. So we can really think about what has changed and what has not changed at this point. And, of course, we can look at this in a sort of a material like this in a kind of nostalgic way of, oh, we've got a broader society. We date with Tinder now. We don't date with, you know, the one guy in town who's the only option for the 3 young women.
Yeah.
So we are in a different world with some of those choices, but I'm fascinated with the things that haven't changed. The 2 young women who are really at the center of the story, Molly and her stepsister, we have Molly who has this mind for science and doesn't know what to do with it because it's a very masculine field. And in some ways, that's still an issue. Very differently, of course, a young woman can pursue science now, but it's still a very male world. And then we have Cynthia, her stepsister, who, you know, it's very unexplicit in the novel, but basically has a sexuality about her. She is interested in being with a man, not necessarily marrying a man. And again, that's done in very delicate language in the 1860s, but it's the same story in some ways when we talk about shaming, we talk about the different ways women are criticized for their sexuality that men are not. We have a very different view even today of female and male sexuality, and that's something that she did, again, 150 years ago, and here we are today going like, wait a minute, some of these issues are actually, they haven't changed.
They're the exact same thing.
They're the same things. Yeah. So just looking at a view of women in society, what's changed, what hasn't changed, how can that sort of give us some information on where we can go next?
Yeah, you pulled a lot of like interesting things I hadn't noticed. I didn't notice that like Molly was like interested in science. Like I didn't think that's a thing that like jumped out to me in like the what I read. And also like, I mean, I guess they said like Cynthia is like worldly, I guess, and I guess that's like a word for, does that mean sexually active? I guess that.
We can sort of use that euphemistically.
Okay.
She's worldly. She's been around.
Okay.
There's implication in the text that she may or may not have had a sexual relationship with a man.
Okay, Mr. Preston or something.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Because like okay, I'm glad you're here. Yeah. This is that flew right over my head. So the description of the play includes a quote about a feminist ahead of her time. Gaskell tackles the meaning of love in all its forms and the limitations society places on women as they pursue their desires. Is there more you could talk about that? Why did you choose to like include that description?
Yeah, I mean, I think that feminism is it's a hot topic right now. It's a word that for some strange reason people think of still sometimes in a negative context. I remember sitting around with a group of my friends just a few weeks ago and saying, how many of you would consider yourselves feminists? And there were people who just said, well, I wouldn't use that word. And the fact that we're afraid to consider ourselves people who just fundamentally think that there should be equal rights for men and women is still a little bit bonkers to me. So here we have this woman who, you know, Gaskell was married, she was very domestic, she lived at home, and yet she had this voice, and she was trying to use this voice. To the themes you said of like what, you know, the fact that she's feminist ahead of her time, I think is key because she says some of the things that I think we are still trying to articulate today. She did in her way, in her voice, in her time. But that's just really, I mean, I think I've sort of circled around this a few times here already this morning. Something that draws me to her, I think anybody who has a voice and is able to articulate things in ways that I can't or I see people struggling with, I think, God, we've got to find a way to use that voice again, expand that voice, get that voice out there. And then just the sort of struggles of the family. there are other things that I just think are super, super relatable. When I think about one of the things that theater does best, it puts a bunch of people in a room to experience a story together. It makes us feel not alone. When we read a book, we're alone. We often watch TV alone. We often watch movies alone now. We don't go out to the theater as much, to the cinema as much. And one of the things that theater does so beautifully is it puts everybody in a room to experience a story and feel not alone together. And this is a story that has that kind of at its central core, the idea of how do you find a way to not be alone in the world? Is that through your family? Is that through your friends? Is that through your romantic relationships? Is that through your academic pursuits? So it was another thing that sort of pulled me into the material was this idea of how do we find ourselves not alone?
So how did you meet that director, and how was it decided that you like the director would direct the play? More generally, just give me like a timeline and like a description of like the adaptation and the production of the play.
So the adaptation has been in process for now, I think maybe 3 years since I started working on it. So I did a very rough draft that we read, I guess, 2 years ago with the group of students in the Department of Theater and Film at the time. And it was really long because I kept all three families in the first version. So we read that play. I think it was over 3 hours. But what was so fantastic about that was it allowed us to have a conversation with faculty, students, about what's really at the heart of this story, what wants to stay in the story, what is actable in the story. There are things that work beautifully in a novel that don't work as well on stage. We need more of a sense of activation to things on stage sometimes. So that was, I guess, 2 years ago we read the first iteration. Then I went back in and carved away and tried to really hone the story in. And then we workshopped it again with another group of actors and started to pick and choose who the characters were. It's a different group of characters in this play, this iteration, than were in the previous iteration. I pulled one out and put two other ones in. And then this summer, I guess it was in June, we sat down with the current group of actors for whom this script is crafted. And we spent a week just workshopping it, saying, what are the other scenes we would like? What are the moments we think are missing in here? What are the pieces that we feel like we've hit too many times? We actually got that the first time. What kind of information about the period would a modern audience maybe not know, and we need to sort of filter that in a line or two somewhere? So that was in June. I think that was in June. It might have been slightly earlier in the summer. And then the acting and directing faculty went about finding a director. So they were looking for somebody who, ideally, we wanted a woman to direct it. We wanted somebody who had dealt with ensemble work. It's very much an ensemble piece. When I write these scripts for the students, I want to make sure that everybody has something to dig into. So we're not just doing the story about one character with a whole bunch of people with tiny little parts to support that. So somebody who could really develop that sense of ensemble, and somebody who could tackle the piece not just to make it feel like it was stuck as a period piece. I think if you're going to do a piece really straightforwardly, you get the BBC on board and you get all the bells and whistles and you do the perfect kind of packaged period piece. But what Courtney was so great about when we sat down to talk about the piece is she said, I'm not a director who would just set this straightforward in period, get all the period trappings to it and do it. She said, I want to know why we're doing this story now. I want it to feel contemporary. I want it to feel relevant. So that was one of the things that was very exciting about the conversations with her. And that was probably the middle of the summer, so sometime in June. And then she sat down and read the script and gave me a few thoughts, a few notes of places where she felt like things could be pushed one direction or another. I did another iteration of the script. So then that went out to the team in July. And then in early August, the designers got started figuring out what the world would be. What would the set look like? Would the costumes be period or not period? And I know there was various conversation about that, about how much would we set this in its time and place, and how much would we set it now? And ultimately, some of the decisions they came to were a lot of the small things, the clothes, the hand props were going to be in the period, because I do think the work is set in that time and we need that context in order to just understand why some of the things are happening. But then the set is set quite contemporary, and the lighting and the sound, and we're trying to make sure that there's always a sort of juxtaposition. So we're aware we're seeing a story that was written 150 years ago, but we're also aware that we are today. These are just people interacting. I don't think my mother will ever hear this, so I think it's fair enough to say that the mother in this story is very much like my mother. you know, there's different sort of quirks about her, but that idea of this mother character, she's the stepmother in this particular story, but who just wants the best for her family, but she goes about it in the kinds of ways that just make you shake your head and go like, oh, that's not the way to do it, but you know it's all out of love and it's all out of care. So, yeah, so that was so Courtney was hired by the acting directing faculty to track her down, but our conversations were very engaging at the beginning because I think of her interest in making sure the story felt like it mattered to do it now.
One of the interesting things that really popped out to me when reading about Gaskell was how similar her, I guess, her life was to Elizabeth, to Molly's, you know, widowed father, sent away, father remarried, like. But I'm not sure if that's just, like, a thing that used to happen, like, you know, in the 17th century for everyone, or, like, if, like, Molly is just, like, kind of just a mirror image of who Elizabeth Gaskell was, and she's, like, drawing a lot from her own experiences.
She does draw from her own experiences, which I think everybody as a writer does to some extent. There's definitely more of me in the play than there is in her version and what my own conflicts are as I move forward with things. But there is a difference in the lifestyle of the 19th century. When I workshopped the adaptation, the first adaptation I did, Tenant of Wildfell Hall, there was a question from the students about why is everybody so interested in this one new person in town? And the realization of like, oh, you are in a town with only a small group of people, you're not on the internet, you don't have a cell phone, your closest neighbors are 2 miles away. There's a different sense of isolation, and in some ways it's one of the reasons I'm attracted to this material, because we're dealing with isolation now because of the internet and cell phones and Tinder, but in such a different way. So the themes are the same, but the tools are quite different. So, what you know, Elizabeth Gaskell is very much reflecting the reality of her world. You know, dying young was much more common, dying in childbirth.
Yeah, I noticed that. That was, like, a very, like, I think everybody in her, like, history or, like, life story, I think she was, like, the sixth child or something, and, like, all, like, the first four children died, and then her brother, like, died later. So it's just, like, very, very, like, tragic time to be in. Generally, I don't know.
I mean, the Brontes, too. I think people are more familiar with the Brontes than they are with Elizabeth Gaskell, even though they're a very similar time period. But the Brontes also had dead siblings, and that emerges in their stories. And so we see that theme come up a lot in 19th century literature, either parents dying in childbirth, children dying young, which was very, maybe it's more a reality of that world and more common than especially in our Western world today. So that permeates things. But I think Gaskell was just, she was writing the people she knew. She was writing the stories she knew. But again, that's where those sort of differences of the fact that there are these two sisters who've chosen not to get married and live together, and the questions that would rise today of like, oh, well, they could still date. Yeah. Well, no, in their world, they're 40, they would not still date. They'd be done. So again, I always enjoy the kind of things that are like, well, what's different and what's the same? The thing that's different is the options. There would be more options today. But the shame of being 40 and not married is actually still the same. There's still questions about, well, what's wrong or what's happened or why does nobody want you? So looking for all those kinds of ways to look at our own time through another time.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you were talking about that, the Bronte sisters especially, I know like Gaskell even wrote like the biography of Charlotte Bronte. I was wondering if, I don't know what category or genre you would put Gaskell's work of Wives and Daughters in. Like, is it like Victorian era, like Dickensian, Gothic? I don't know which one, like, I don't know what it is. So I was wondering if you had any, like, thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Gaskell, I would say she wrote domestic comedy, which some might consider reductive. But the Brontes wrote much more sweeping Gothic pieces. I mean, Charlotte Bronte, there's always, you know, some very dark scenes in her work. Obviously, Emily Bronte with Wuthering Heights, if anybody's read her work. And then Anne Bronte wrote stuff that was a little bit more didactic. The three sisters are quite different personalities, but they all have these brooding figures in them and this darkness and this heavy symbolism. You know, there's this undercurrent of dogs and nature and weather and darkness and lightness. And Gaskell didn't have that kind of heavy layer of symbolism in her work. It's not as atmospheric as we might think of as the Brontes, or certainly I would definitely not call Gaskell's work Gothic. I mean, she makes jokes about the the cow next door and how you get milk from the cow. So she tells the sort of small details of her life, and there's a joy in her work. There's a humor in her work and a levity. You know, like I was talking about the stepmother character and how I relate to her in terms of my own relationship with my mother. But there's a humor, there's a bit of exaggeration, there's a kind of, everybody's just a little bit crazy in her work, but in a very loving way.
Cool. Anything else you'd like to add? Any comments, insights, observations?
I don't think so. I mean, I saw a run through of Act Two on Sunday, and I think the actors are really starting to just own the material and get the characters. There were some great funny moments. I'm hoping that the humor really comes through. It's one of the things I had a lot of fun with working on the material, is that with both Charlotte Bronte's work and Anne Bronte's work, there's not a huge amount of overt humor in them. There's subtle humor, but not the kind of things, like, we wouldn't call them comedies. And this one, I would call this one a comedy. I would call her novel a comedy. And so one of the things that I'm excited about and that I'm hoping we really see as the actors continue to finesse things over the next couple weeks is I'm hoping it's just fun. I think again, we often think of this kind of material as being very gothic and very dark. In some ways, I think the artwork even makes it feel a little bit dark. And ultimately, it's like it's a dysfunctional family. Like, this could be a sitcom,
a slightly different.